It's Something for Nothing, the Rush Fan Cast. Jerry and Steve with you. Jerry, we made it through the fall season. This is episode number 5.
That's right. We had to take a little break, you know, to rest our voices, but we're back.
Well, we had some reading to do. We had a great book to read, My Effin' Life, and we're going to talk about it today.
It is a great book. I guess we'll get into that, right?
We will. You can find us on Twitter. We are at Rush Fancast. Instagram and Threads, we're at The Rush Cast. Email Jerry, therushcast@gmail.com. And if you're hearing us for the first time, now this is going to be our last episode for a while, so it's possible people are listening to this episode first. So I just wanted to let everyone know that you can find us on Podbean and find all 180 episodes there. Listen from the beginning.
Sure. Start from, maybe start episode 5 or 6, actually.
Episode 5 is a good place to start. And the bass intro and outro, that is Lex doing Turn the Page. That's an interesting choice for today, don't you think?
It's very clever. Did you come up with that one, Steve?
Yeah, that was my idea. What do you think?
That's good. I like it.
All right. Give us an email, Jared, to get us started.
All right. Well, this is from John. So he says, this happened a few weeks ago as I was pulling into a parking lot for work, and this car was right behind me. So I moved further into the lot, and he kept following me. I was like, what's up with this guy? So I pulled into a spot, and he pulls up and gets out of his car. I was starting to wonder if I should be worried when he said, I don't mean to freak you out, but I was behind you and saw your stickers and your license plate and had to say hi. And he attached a picture of his license plate. It says Bytor.
And what state is it?
It is Iowa.
Okay. Iowa plates, Bytor. That's cool.
We ended up talking for about 5 minutes about our Rush origin stories, how we both cried the day we found out Neil died, and about the crazy shows we've been to. On a hunch, I gave him my business card that had my cell phone on it, hoping this guy wasn't too crazy. Anyway, we are now meeting up in Chicago for the Getty Book Tour. I always knew that adorning my car with a few Rush hints would garner new Rush friendships, and it has. Our town in Iowa is only about 24,000 people, and it only took about 2 years, but it was totally worth it. It's so good to have you guys back making even some limited episodes. They are fantastic, and I look forward to many more. And he has a PS.
Okay.
The question I submitted to Getty for the Chicago show is, would you ever consider being interviewed on the best Rush podcast, Something for Nothing? If it works, you're welcome.
That's so nice. Thank you, John. We really appreciate it. And I think for the New York show, a couple of listeners told us that they also sent Getty questions about possibly appearing on our podcast.
That is true. They didn't read them, though. And
of course not.
They didn't read his question either at the Chicago show.
Look, like we keep saying, it totally makes sense that Getty does not do this podcast. First of all, he probably doesn't even know about it. There's number one.
Number one, yes.
And secondly, if he did, he doesn't know us, so it doesn't make any sense for him to do it, really.
Well, don't talk him out of it before he's even found out about it, Steve.
No. I'm not trying to talk him out of it, because we would do right by Getty. You know that. I know that.
Of course.
And our listeners know that, but Getty doesn't know that.
Right.
And if he hears this now, he knows it now.
Right.
But does he believe us?
That's true. Well, you know, if we're just going to jump right into the book.
We are.
He talked at length just about how letting people into the fold hasn't always worked out for him, as evidenced by the examples given in the book.
You know, he made some exceptions. He talked about Andrew McNaughton coming to his house.
Right.
As a fan, just to say hello, and that this guy turned out to be one of his best friends in the world.
I know.
Is pretty incredible, don't you think?
It is. It's also incredible that Getty would just answer his own door. I don't know why.
Well, why wouldn't he answer his door?
I don't know. I don't even answer my door. Someone knocks on my door and I'm like, who is at my door?
Anyway, why don't we start from the beginning of the book? The book is called My Effin' Life. And the first thing I wanted to talk about, Jer, is the name of the book. Now, I have not read anywhere anyone asking Getty about what the origin of the name is, but I have a theory, and I think you may have the same theory.
I do. I have the same exact theory. Why don't you lay out what it is?
Well, Getty, as you know, is an avid bird watcher.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe he's also a fan of effin' birds.
Yes. The hilarious bird book.
The hilarious bird book. And there's a website and they sell merchandise. And you see Getty in a lot of pictures wearing the t-shirt that says, I'm a goddamn delight.
Right.
I forget what kind of bird there is on the t-shirt.
You gave me that shirt for my birthday one year.
I did. I did. I saw Getty wearing it and I said, well, you've got to have that too. But I think he borrowed the effing birds title and took it on for himself.
I think he did. Maybe, you know, effing birds isn't as popular as we think it is. I think it's popular because I have the book and I follow the dude everywhere. And I think he's hilarious.
I agree. I don't think it's as popular as you and I think it is. And so no one's asked Getty about it because why would they?
Right.
And I think that's where he got it from.
I guess also he says that he curses a lot, which I admire.
Yeah.
I curse a lot too in my normal life.
We made the decision not to curse a lot on this podcast, but we could have if we wanted to.
It was hard. You had to cut out a lot of pauses where I just wanted to drop an F-bomb here and there.
But I found out today, I saw our friend John from Cygnus X1 posted that Getty's book debuted at number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list. How cool is that?
That's great. And it's well-deserved.
So I guess the first question is how you feel the book was written. Do you think it's a well-written book?
I do think it's a well-written book. It was very engaging throughout. And you could tell that he worked on it really hard because he says that the initial manuscript was 1,200 pages.
Yeah.
He said that when we saw him at the Beacon Theater in New York, which is ridiculous to reduce a 1,200-page book down to 500-some-odd pages. So he did a lot of work rewriting this book, you can tell.
Yeah, and the thing I love about it is that it's written in his voice.
Yeah.
When he's reading it in the audiobook, it doesn't sound like he's reading. It just sounds like he's talking to you. When he read at the show, it was very smooth. It sounded like he was talking to us. It didn't sound like he was reading.
Yeah.
That's a credit to how much work Getty put into it.
Yes. I love everything about this book. It's one of the best rock and roll, I was going to say autobiographies. He calls it a memoir. I'm not sure if there's a big difference between the two. I mean, I know there's a difference between the two, but he calls it a memoir. So let's call it a memoir.
Now, did you read the book cover to cover? Did you download the audiobook at all?
I didn't download the audiobook. I just read it.
Well, I decided to download the audiobook, and you can go to Amazon and download it for free. All you have to do is sign up for Audible, and they give you the book for free.
Oh, nice.
You can cancel after a month, and you get to keep the book.
I don't think I've ever listened to an audiobook.
Well, you know, I normally don't like to listen to audiobooks, but I listened to Neil's book, The Clockwork Angels book.
Oh.
And it was so great to hear Neil read it because I had read it after Neil died.
Right.
So it was just great to hear his voice. And I decided I got limited time to read this book, and I do a lot of commuting, and I've got 3 hours a day either in the car or on the bus. So I figured I'd read it a little bit and I'd let Getty read it to me the other times.
Like a bedtime story.
Yeah. And I would say the first half of the book, I went half and half. And then after that, I just listened. And it was so great hearing Getty read the book. He got so emotional at points. I felt like I got a lot more out of it. And I would really recommend that you listen to it again.
Interesting.
Just to hear it more from Getty's perspective. I think you would enjoy it.
Oh, okay. And what does, I know that Alex makes an appearance. What is he reading?
Well, we could talk about that when we get to those parts of the book.
Okay.
He reads three different passages in the book, and Cliff Bernstein reads the passage talking about when he signed the band.
Oh, okay.
So the book starts out with Getty telling us the origin of his name, and during the show we saw at the Beacon, he read this passage of the book.
Yeah.
I don't know if we gleaned anything new here. I mean, it's a little more in detail. Your thoughts on that part?
Well, it's a very Call Me Ishmael beginning.
Yes.
Because, you know, he's just like, what is this guy's name? He grew up thinking he had a different middle name. I thought it was very interesting to just get a glimpse about how he thinks of himself. Like, what is his own identity? He's got a bunch of different names. He's got his, you know, his given name, his middle name, which his mom confused with his cousin's middle name for a long time. And then he has his name that his friends call him. And then he has his stage name. I just think it's interesting that he's changing his personality almost in different stages of his life. And it owes a lot, of course, to his background and how he had to fit in the different parts of his life as he moved through them.
And he does it, as he does a lot of things in this book, with a sense of humor. And you get to see a little bit of what you're going to get throughout the rest of the book, and that's Getty being Getty.
Yeah, there are some very funny things. There's one funny thing I want to read when we get to it.
Okay. So chapter one gets into Getty's childhood, and his father died when he was 10, which is tragic. Yeah. And that has a lot to do with setting up Getty's life for what's to come. And it's a tough thing to go through. I mean, he had to mourn for a year. That's the Jewish tradition, right?
11 months and a day or something like that.
That's crazy.
As he says in the book, it's definitely nice to have some kind of structure at times like that. While it's difficult, you know, for him, he had to say some prayers three times a day for 11 months or whatever, which was terrible. He couldn't listen to music, couldn't really see his friends or do anything fun. But after that was over, then you're just like, you're back to your,
right,
you know, normal life, which is a really great ritual to observe because it gets everybody off the hook about starting their life over again.
And to me, the not listening to music thing, that is huge because that's the formative years of you becoming a music fan. I mean, if you couldn't listen to music the whole year when you were 11 years old, you would have missed out on a lot.
And he did. He says he did miss out on a lot. And I think that helped to drive his passion for music because I think he realized how much he missed it and how integral a part of his life it was.
And the other thing was discovering that his father was also a musician, which he didn't know before he died, which to me is incredible.
Right. A lot of the book is sad.
Yes.
A lot of it is sad.
One thing about the first chapter, he mentioned that Rick Moranis was his classmate in grade school, which is kind of a cool thing. And then Rick, of course, called him up in the early 80s and asked him to perform on their song Take Off.
Right.
Bob and Doug McKenzie. And a fact that I did not know is that Take Off was Getty's top charting hit.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It hit number 16 on the U.S. charts, which was better than Rush ever did.
That's right.
Which is incredible to me.
I had that album. That was a great, it was a great comedy album.
Oh, it was awesome. I had it on cassette. That was one of my Columbia House, taking this back to the first episode. I got 13 Columbia House records.
Right.
Bob and Doug McKenzie was one of them.
The Great White North.
The Great White North. I had it on cassette, one of those crappy cassettes that was just a copy. So in chapter two, we get into the teenage years after this period of mourning, getting made fun of in school, that sort of thing. The typical growing up kind of stuff.
Yeah, a little atypical to our experience, though, because he was one of the only Jewish kids in his school. He talks a lot about his looks and how he felt like everything in his life just set him apart from everybody else in his class and in his neighborhood.
Right.
I think it just also just speaks to all of the things that conspire in your life to make you who you are. As we get to chapter three, we hear stories about his parents and his relatives in the Holocaust. And all of these things make him the person that he is. He feels like he needs to go after the things that he wants in life while he can go after them. You know, after hearing all of those horrific stories from his mom over the years and, you know, experiencing his dad's death at such a young age, he realizes that he's got to grab for what he can when he can. And it's a driving force in his music from then on.
Yeah, and he's got to do what he wants. He dropped out of high school and pursued his dream.
Yeah.
Which you give him a lot of credit for sure.
Yeah, and Neil dropped out of high school too, if I recall correctly, which is, can you imagine going to your parents when we were in high school, Steve, and telling them you wanted to drop out to be a bass player?
I can't imagine. They would have been beside themselves.
It's unthinkable, but it just, I have so much admiration for people who do things like that. Like Dave Grohl did it too. He was just like, high school's just not where I want to be. Drops out of high school.
So you mentioned chapter three, when Getty gets into the story of his parents' experience during World War II, and hearing Getty read this chapter, it was gut-wrenching, Jer. I mean, I was getting teary-eyed. You might have been just reading it, but hearing Getty read it, I could almost not get through it.
It's brutal. I mean, not that you would expect anything less from a story from the Holocaust, but the terrible, terrible things that his parents went through and his other relatives went through. And then to be able to start their life over again and raise children and have faith in God. It's an extraordinary tale of survival.
Yeah. I mean, his mother was out shopping or something when the bombs first started to drop, and she was missing for a couple of days, right?
Right.
And they had no idea where she was. They thought she was dead, and thankfully she wasn't.
Yeah, and just how his parents met again after the war was over. I really didn't, toward the end of that chapter, there's a story about when he and his siblings and their mom went to Germany. They went to the 50th anniversary,
yes,
of the liberation of the camps. And there was an English soldier who was one of the guys who came to liberate the camp. That's when I broke down reading it, because that guy was...
That was the same point when I did, too.
His wife said that he had been haunted for his entire life from just liberating the camp, just seeing everybody in the camp when they arrived. So you can only imagine what it would be like to actually live through it for years.
It's incredible. Just an incredible story of survival.
It is.
And the fact that his father searched and searched for his mother for God knows how long and then happened to find her, and they get married in a liberation camp.
I know. And then when they go, when his family goes back to the camp, they're having dinner in the same room that his parents were married in.
Incredible. Just incredible. And to tie it back in with Rush, of course, his mother was in shock when the British came to save them. And she had no idea that they were not the last people left alive on Earth. That's what she thought.
I know. Which informs the line in Red Sector A.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Neil heard the story that Getty told him and turned it into Red Sector A. But the book is written in such a way where you could skip chapter 3, and Getty suggests that you might want to. You could skip chapter 3 and not really miss anything.
Yeah, but I wouldn't. I mean, just as a historical record.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think you should skip it. I think you should read it.
I agree. I think you should read it. Absolutely. So chapter 4, more childhood. Getty discovers more music, and he meets Alex, which is a key point in Getty's life.
Yeah. I tell you, throughout the book, he and Alex have such an interesting relationship. It seems like Getty and Neil they playfully gang up on Alex a lot.
Yeah.
And make fun of him a lot for all the goofy stuff that he does.
And he joins Rush, and they play their first gig at the Coff Inn, which is a great name for a venue.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And then in chapter 5, we get into the early days of Rush, right? And Ray Daniels comes on board to manage them, and Getty gets kicked out of the band.
And Getty gets kicked out of the band, right? The thing to remember, too, is Ray was young. Everybody in this story is so young.
Yeah.
It's just crazy how, you know, they were so driven to be a great band, and Ray was driven to, I don't know, be a great manager?
Yeah.
He was just very, very driven guy as well.
Yeah, and I guess if you're a manager at that time, you're a young manager, you're trying to hook on with a great young band that you can kind of grab the coattails of and ride them to the end. And that's what Ray did.
That's what Ray did, yeah.
Not that he was a complete coattail rider, but you know what I mean.
No, I don't know what you mean. Yeah. Because I'm sure there were tons of bands playing all the bars back then anyway, so.
Yeah, you want to hook up with the one that's going to be successful.
Yeah.
And the thing that amazed me about the whole story about Getty getting kicked out of the band, Paul Rudd mentioned it in the show we saw at the Beacon, and Getty talked about it there.
Yeah.
But he had no idea who was behind it until just recently.
I know.
That's crazy.
He kept it a secret all these years.
He just didn't bother to ask Alex. I mean, come on, that doesn't come up in 40 years.
Well, that was another thing that I found interesting. The book isn't really like your regular rock and roll autobiography. It's not just a lot of road stories and a lot of funny stories and a lot of stories about, you know, partying and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of interpersonal relationship examination going on in this book, where he talks at length about how he and Alex didn't really talk about a lot of things, especially about the synth years, about how Alex felt.
Right.
And that doesn't come out until later, when he's talking about writing the book, and he's like, I should ask Alex how he felt. And then they have this conversation, and Getty's like, oh, geez, I never knew you felt like that.
That really is incredible.
It is.
And not that they didn't talk a lot. I mean, they hung out a lot. They were talking all the time, and they just didn't talk about serious stuff, I guess.
Well, yeah, they just, he talks also at length about his marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just easier to just ignore things if, you know, and just kind of roll with it, which is, you know, works for a while, I guess. I guess with the band, though, you know, they had so many other things to focus on that they just kind of got through it and moved on to the next thing.
But I think what you see as the book goes along is being in a marriage and being in a band have quite a bit of similarities.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And if you don't communicate with your spouse and you don't communicate with your bandmates, things get out of whack.
Yeah, that's true.
For sure. And then, of course, Getty is invited back into the band.
Thankfully.
Thankfully. It turns out John Rutsey was the man behind kicking him out.
Right.
And John ends up asking him back.
And, you know, he talks about John leaving the band. I think we've all heard that story before, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's really nothing new. I thought if we were ever going to find out if there was anything else behind John leaving the band. There's lots of theories and stories that I've heard from people, but it's exactly like we thought, you know, he wasn't as committed as Getty and Alex were, and he just wasn't into touring, and he wanted to play a different type of music than what Getty and Alex were coming up with.
But it was good hearing Getty's perspective on it, even though we sort of knew the story already.
Yeah. It's good to hear it from the horse's mouth.
Now in chapter 7, they have their first opening gig with the New York Dolls, and this is the first appearance of Alex in the book. So the passage when Alex is telling the story about that New York Dolls gig,
yeah,
when they end up in the car with somebody from the show and then they have to hitchhike.
Oh, yeah, that's a great story.
Yeah, so Alex tells that story in the book. So that's the first appearance of Alex, and it was great.
After the show, he has to hitchhike home. He gets picked up by some people who were at the show. He asks them how they liked the show, and they were like, oh, it was great, but the opening band was terrible. And Alex just has to sit there.
And then they stop at a light, and they just, Getty and Alex just jumped out of the car, and then they had to walk home from there.
So funny.
So at this point, Terry Brown is brought in, as you mentioned, Jared, the young Terry Brown brought in to save sort of the debut album, which was not sounding great for Getty and Alex.
Yeah. The one thing I found interesting from the early years, from around this time, is that Getty and Alex were writing the music, but they didn't have the lyrics yet.
Right.
So Getty would, he called it scatting. He would just make up melodies and words or just sounds to fill in where he felt the lyrics should go. And that is foundational to his relationship with Neil.
Yes.
Coming up with melodies in place of lyrics, and you have to, you know, like merge the two. So he was doing that already. And I think that is just great practice for what he needed to do later on to make them so successful.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And then they get into the story of WMMS and Donna Halper, which we've heard before, and nothing really new there for me. I would imagine you agree.
Yeah, this, it's stuff we've heard before.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I said before, it's so well written. It's engaging throughout, even though you might have heard some of the stories before.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm not tossing it aside like it's not worth reading. It's just not worth us discussing at this point. And then the head of national radio promotion at Mercury Records,
yeah,
Cliff Bernstein, appears to tell his story of signing the band. So if you're listening to the audiobook, Cliff Bernstein does the reading of this portion of the book, which is cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
So then we get into the release of the debut album, Jer, an exciting point in Rush's career.
That's right. Getty talks about the white Corvette pulling up to offer Neil the job.
And Howard Ungerleiter jumps on board here to be the tour manager.
Yeah.
And I've been pronouncing his name wrong this whole time we've been doing the podcast, Jer. I've been calling him Howard Ungerleiter. And Getty says Ungerleiter, which I would assume is correct.
You would hope it's correct.
Ian Grandy and Liam Burt were also in the crew, so that was the 6-person crew, and I thought it was cool in the book. You saw the hotel room schedule where they switched up who they were rooming with every night, which I thought was an interesting thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, Getty, he kept everything. He referred to himself when we saw him as a hoarder. And I'm guessing it's true. I mean, he kept the schedule that I guess Neil had written for the tour. I mean, that's just the weirdest thing to keep. Just written on some kind of scrap paper where everybody was just like, you know, this is who you're rooming with for the next month.
The interesting thing about it was every night they roomed with a different person.
Right. That was a smart thing to do.
Getty would room with Howard one night. He would room with Alex one night. He would room with Neil the other night. And then Ian, they just swapped roommates every single night, which you would think would be the opposite. Like they just pick one person they could deal with and stick with them the whole tour.
I think he mentions in the book that they did that so that nobody would get on each other's nerves, which I think is a great thing to do.
Smart. And probably Neil's idea, I bet.
Very smart thing to do. And it also gave everybody one night a week to have a room to themselves.
So then we get into the touring with Kiss. Paul Rudd mentioned this to Getty on the book tour, and Getty gets into how much they enjoyed touring with Kiss and how Kiss was good to them.
Yeah, Kiss was great to them. Gave them sound checks every day or as many days as they could, as opposed to a lot of other opening bands.
There were a couple of points in the book where Getty really made sure he digged on certain people, like Aerosmith.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Aerosmith did not give Rush a sound check, and Getty was crystal clear about that in the book.
He mentions more than once that he is an incredible grudge holder.
Yeah.
And he still has not forgiven the guys at Aerosmith for all those years ago, man. It's so funny.
Well, here's the thing about Kiss, though. One of the points in the book, he mentions that he and Alex threw some groupies out of the backstage area.
Yeah.
And Gene Simmons was not happy.
Oh, yeah.
And he threw Getty up against the wall and yelled at him for throwing the groupies out.
Right.
I wonder if Getty's relationship with Gene was hurt by that incident, because it seemed like he was holding that grudge, too.
Yeah, I mean, well, Gene was in the documentary, so probably didn't go the other way, right?
Right, but I wonder if Getty still doesn't love Gene all that much because of that.
Yeah, Gene's hard to take, even from a even from a fan perspective or just a casual rock and roll observer. Gene's a little hard to take.
If this were a Kiss podcast, I'd tell my story about meeting Gene, but there's no time for it now. If Shout It Out Loud wants to have me on to talk about that, I would love to do it, but not here.
Oh my God, it's such a good story.
Gene's a dick. Let's just say that. Oh, man. So chapter 10, we get into Fly By Night, Jer, and Neil takes the bull by the horns and starts writing lyrics.
So I've heard the story before about the first song that Neil wrote the lyrics for, Beneath, Between, and Behind.
Yeah.
Which to me is one of the craziest songs that you could possibly write. As your first song, so many words, such a high concept, and just being like, yeah, this is my first attempt at writing lyrics.
And imagine Getty getting handed these lyrics and being like, what?
This is a mouthful, man. How am I even going to say that? And that's where his habit of, you know, scatting and coming up with these melodies in lieu of having words probably just dovetailed with his need to sing these ridiculously long words in this absolutely packed song.
Really incredible. The other cool thing about this section is Getty tells a story about Neil getting in a big fight with the lawyers at SRO.
Right.
About compromise.
Yeah.
And I thought it was kind of a window into how Neil felt about this and how the band did. They were not going to compromise.
Yeah, they were all on the same page.
Yeah.
They needed to be if they were going to do everything. None of them could give in. And, you know, they didn't really know the new guy that well, right? And
right.
Here he was saying exactly what they would have said to the lawyers.
I mean, what are the chances that Getty and Alex audition this guy and he's just the perfect fit, not only musically, but just philosophy-wise with the band?
I know. It's just incredible that it happened at all.
Really is. So chapter 11, Caress of Steel, Jared. Lots of weed, lots of hash oil making this record.
It's true. And lots of disappointment from everybody around them. And that's the one thing I wanted to mention, the one quote. It's from the part of the book where Getty is playing Caress of Steel for Paul Stanley.
Yes, yes.
There's a footnote.
Yes, the footnote's great. You got to read this.
I thought it was the funniest thing in the world. So he tells the story about how they were in, you know, how they played it for Paul Stanley, and Paul Stanley didn't get it or whatever.
Right.
And he says, I do remember Alex and me playing Caress of Steel to Paul Stanley when we were on the road together. He looked uncomfortable and clearly did not get it, or just thought it was weird as hell. Of course, it is an effing weird record, but remember, we're talking about a guy who sang Strutter every night, so it wouldn't have been his bag no matter what.
Strutter.
Oh, that's great. And I thought the funny thing was that Getty, listening back to the record now, thought that there was so much more echo in the record that there turned out to be. And he thinks it sounds completely dry now, but at the time, he thought it sounded awesome.
Right. Well, it could have been the weed and the hash oil.
Oh, absolutely. Said. That's exactly what it was. But you and I love this record. We run into so many people that love this record. I know the band doesn't like it. The record company didn't like it. We love it.
Yep.
So 2112, Rush's last chance to make a statement, according to Getty. They decided to do it their way. Go down swinging. Getty using the baseball reference there.
It's true. And they did. I mean, what else is to say about 2112, right?
Yeah, well, one thing I didn't know that was revealed in the book is that the Twilight Zone was a spontaneous studio track. I didn't know that they just kind of threw that in at the last minute, wrote it on a whim, and became a great tune.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. So that was a nice little trivia thing, too.
And we don't want to give away too much stuff, but Getty does tell the story, the origin story of the robes in this chapter.
Yeah, that's true.
But read it yourself. We don't need to detail it.
Yeah.
More touring, more opening acts, lots of stuff going on here.
Right.
So in chapter 13, we get into Getty's wedding, which I thought the pictures were incredible.
Yeah, that's true. They were. And he sat John at the same table with Neil at his wedding.
That must have been an incredible conversation. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall and hear what those two guys talked about.
Yeah. Especially since they had never really talked to John about his leaving the band after he left.
Right.
And Getty Stills invites him to his wedding, but then sits him with Neil. That's just got to be uncomfortable, like you said, for everybody.
Maybe, but maybe it wasn't. I mean, maybe John didn't hold any grudges at all. Maybe John was happy with the fact that he left the band. Who knows?
Yeah, that's true.
We don't know. But knowing Neil, he probably made the conversation easy.
Yeah, I'm sure he did.
He doesn't seem like the type of guy to have an awkward conversation. I don't know why.
Yeah, that's true. When he's comfortable, right?
He'd find something to talk about that would make it less uncomfortable, I think.
One thing I was surprised about during this time, I guess it's during the Farewell to Kings onward, is the admission that Getty was doing a lot of cocaine.
I was just about to say that. I mean, crazy. I had no idea.
No idea.
Schna.
Schna, right. They have a nickname for everything, these guys. I was just surprised because I always assumed that they didn't really go in for all of the, you know, trappings of the rock and roll lifestyle.
Luckily for Getty and Alex, and I'm guessing Neil was doing this stuff too. I mean, that's the thing I wasn't sure about. It was clear that Getty was doing the coke.
Right.
And I was pretty sure that Alex was, but was Neil also?
I didn't get that sense, no.
You don't think so?
I don't know. I mean, I didn't get this. He didn't come out and say that Neil was.
Right.
So I don't really know.
But he used the word we a lot.
That's true.
They're in the studio recording A Farewell to Kings. They go out and play volleyball and do lines of coke.
Right.
Now, who's we? Is it Getty and Alex? Is it Getty, Alex, Terry, and Neil? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
I really wish we had Terry on next week so we could ask him.
Right. It would have been great to read this book before.
Right.
We talked to Terry.
True.
There's so many tidbits in here
mm-hmm.
that we could have asked him about.
But I think the fact that we didn't know about it is because nothing bad happened, thankfully.
Thankfully, yeah. Nothing bad happened. It's true.
I think that they didn't go overboard, though. You know, it sounded to me like they didn't do coke before the shows. They waited, for the most part, after the show.
Yeah, and Getty said a couple times, though, he would sneak off on the side of the stage.
Right.
When it started getting, I guess, bad for him, and I guess that's when he gave it up, when he realized. Well, the good thing about the three of them is that they always put the band first.
Right.
Good for the band, maybe not so good for Getty's other relationships, putting the band first.
Right.
He talks a lot about his regret about touring so much, leaving his family so much, especially after his son was born, which again is, I think, an unusual thing for a rock and roll memoir. It's so filled with, I'm going to say terrible things, but it has a lot. It's a very heavy, heavy book, and it's not your usual rock and roll memoir.
Well, that's why I like it so much. I think it's really the story of Getty's life, not Getty's rock and roll life.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Very well put, Steve.
Yeah. So next we get into chapter 14. This is the point where there's an interview in the New Musical Express where Rush is described as fascists. And this really, really disturbs Getty. And I can understand why.
Yeah, the guy came in with an agenda and riled Neil up, I think.
Yeah, and he used the words that were also on the sign at the Nazi concentration camps.
Oh, that's right.
In the article.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine how beside himself Getty was after reading that.
Oh, yeah, he was livid, it seemed like.
I mean, of all people to say he's a fascist, Getty Lee, I mean, come on.
Yeah, I know.
Ridiculous.
A rock and roll band.
Also here, Getty gets into the genius of Alex Lifeson, which goes without saying, but Getty gets into detail about how amazing Alex is. And the story that I'd never heard of Xanadu getting all mashed up in the tape machine when they were mixing it.
I know, that's incredible. That it started unspooling as they were transferring it or mastering it, right? That's got to be scary.
And Terry somehow saved it.
Right. And it was from then on out that they started to make copies of everything before they shipped the tapes off to get mastered. They made copies of them.
It's kind of amazing that they hadn't been doing that before, though.
I know. I guess it takes a scare like that sometimes to get you to do things the correct way.
So another part that Getty read on his book tour. Now, I'm not sure if he read the same excerpts at the other shows that he did at ours. But he read the story about Alex in the hotel room in Manchester in 1978, where Alex breaks his hotel room window, which is an incredible story.
Yeah.
And he details it here in the book.
But again, that was a story that sprang out of Alex being at his breaking point and missing his family.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just your average rock and roll excess. And that's what I'm talking about. There's a lot of stuff about how their life as a rock and roll band affected everybody around them. Getty is acutely aware and very sensitive to how they're affecting everybody in their lives with their ridiculous touring, their constant recording. I mean, what do you say? They put out 10 albums in 10 years or something like that?
Yeah.
It's an incredible output. And he kind of regrets it. He doesn't regret it. He doesn't regret the albums. He doesn't regret the music. He doesn't regret the tours. He just regrets he couldn't do other things as well, like, you know, be there for his wife.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if Getty would change anything about his life story. Would he do things different knowing how everything turned out now?
I mean, it's hard to say, right? If he did things different, it wouldn't turn out the way it turned out.
Right. Career-wise, it turned out fantastic.
Right.
And I believe his marriage is great now. So maybe he wouldn't do anything differently, but it's kind of hard not to do anything differently knowing all the pain you caused for yourself.
Yeah, and it is definitely unusual that he remained married for so long.
Yeah.
So many other people would have, because he talks about, I can't remember who he talks about. Maybe it was Pete Way.
Yeah, it was Pete Way. He was married six times.
Six times.
Yeah.
Which I think is, you know, par for the course.
Yeah, well, it just goes to show you how much Getty and Nancy love each other and the fact that they worked at it. They went to therapy. They worked through their issues.
Yeah.
So they also get into here the problems that they had recording Hemispheres. We talked to Terry about that, and we hear Getty's side of the story here, which is similar to what Terry told us.
Yeah, that's true. It's just an incredible oversight.
Yeah. But it could have been the beginnings of the rift that started to develop between Terry and the band. Because Getty did admit that he felt like the producer should have known that this was going to happen.
Right. He should have picked up on that.
So it could have been the beginnings of what became Terry leaving the Rush camp.
That's true. Which he would do in a few years.
Yes. Now, also during the book tour, Getty talked about the song Free Will, and he talks about it here also, that during the pandemic, people would walk up to him wearing a mask and just say, "Hey man, free will," which is ridiculous.
It's absolutely the most ridiculous thing ever. As he says in the book, and it's true, you still have a responsibility to the people around you. You can exercise your free will and still keep other people in mind. It's not free will, that's selfishness.
Yeah. I mean, that was absolutely not the idea behind the song Free Will. I can just do whatever I want, and who cares what anybody else thinks or if they all live or die.
Right. It's definitely a case of people reading into things what they want to believe. It is people just looking for things to reinforce the way they already think.
And like Getty said at the show, and he says in the book, terms and conditions apply.
That's true. That's true.
Next, we get into moving pictures. Chapter 17 gets into detail on moving pictures. I thought the cool thing was seeing the original lyrics by Pai Dubois of Louis the Warrior. Can you imagine if they ended up calling the song Louis the Warrior, how awful that would be?
That would be pretty bad. That is definitely not a good title.
And Rush exploded here. Things changed for them. More demands on their time. People coming to Getty's house. He had to move.
I know. They move. Again, it's another story about his relationship with his wife. They move out to the country, and she's by herself for the most time because he's touring, and it's just another strain.
Yeah.
Another way that the band is interfering with his personal life.
Yep. And he starts talking about how he's becoming more and more enamored with keyboards, and this becomes his new love.
Yeah. And he finally talks to Alex about it, right?
Right.
Especially when they get, as he's writing the book, he's just like, "Oh, I don't think I ever really asked Alex." And Alex has an interesting thing to say.
Yeah, Alex basically read this part in the book and said to Getty, he wasn't happy about how his guitar was fitting in. He felt like an outside musician, is what he said.
Right, and they had never really talked about it before. They didn't talk about it at the time, and this was like the first time that Getty was hearing that kind of opinion from Alex after all these years.
Yeah, and he says now that he feels like a fool for not considering Alex's feelings about the situation.
Right, and this went on for two albums.
Yeah, and Rush moves on from Terry Brown, and throughout these chapters in the middle here, they're going through producers. So they tell the story of getting Peter Henderson. And Getty really rips into Steve Lillywhite for turning them down. We've heard that story before.
He sure does.
We talked about that when we talked about Grace Under Pressure.
Yeah.
And of course, Peter Collins producing Power Windows and Hold Your Fire. And then Rupert Hine.
Do you know who else Peter Collins has produced a few albums for?
I don't.
The Indigo Girls.
The Indigo Girls. Of course, the Indigo Girls. How could I forget?
He doesn't mention that in the book, though.
Oh, he doesn't?
No, I thought it would be. I thought it was an interesting dovetailing of my interests.
And we talked about this before. He talks about meeting Andrew McNaughton at his door, which is crazy to me.
Yeah.
And another part here, which I thought was great, them listing off the names that Alex used to use for himself at hotels, like Mike Oxenfire. And Colonel Dick Hertz.
Yeah.
There's a bunch more, but they're pretty cool.
At one point, Getty talks about how he checked into a hotel and found out that there was a basketball player who had checked in under the name Getty Lee, which I think is hilarious. I told my daughter that, and she's like, "Who was it?" I forget which basketball player it was, right? It's just a funny thing to, like, you're trying to use names so that nobody would recognize you, and he uses Getty Lee.
Yeah. But in between Signals and Test for Echo, Getty goes through the recording of all those albums, the producers they had. I mean, we could detail all this stuff, but we'll be here forever.
Yeah.
And chapter 22 is where things come to a screeching halt. Getty receives a call from Ray Daniels that Neil's daughter, Selena, was in a car accident. This was August 11th, 1997. And Getty's just going through so many awful things in his life, so many deaths that just are gut-wrenching.
Yeah. And he, you know, every time when things happen like that, he's just reminded of, like you said, everything that happened not only to him and his past, but also to his entire family, you know?
And then less than a year later, Neil's wife Jackie's diagnosed with lung cancer, and she died on June 20th, 1998.
Yeah, I know. It's another heartbreaking chapter in this book.
And after that, Getty would only hear from Neil on his birthday. Neil would send Getty an email every year on his birthday without fail.
Yeah.
And other than that, just postcards. Wherever Neil was, he would send a postcard addressed to Getty with one of Getty's nicknames so he would know who yeah. it was from. And there was nothing on the postcard. So just so Getty would know he's still alive and somewhere.
Right.
Just so sad. All that's so sad.
Yeah, and obviously, to hear more about that story, you have to read Ghost Rider, Neil's book, Ghost Rider.
Yeah, yeah. So after that, Getty gets into My Favorite Headache, and he wrote the song Gone for Selena, which we've just heard recently. And thankfully, he didn't put it on the album, which I think that was the right choice at the time.
Yeah, he said it was just too raw of a nerve to put on the album. I haven't heard the songs since the Beacon show, though, because I didn't buy the audiobook, and I haven't been able to find them anyplace else.
Well, I guess we're not going to talk about them today, then, are we?
Maybe some other time, yeah. I haven't listened to them, right, because they're in the audiobook, but I thought they would be on Spotify or something, but I didn't find them there.
Yeah, they're along with the audiobook. You have to download the audiobook, and you get the songs with the audiobook.
Right.
We'll talk about them on a future episode.
Sure.
One thing that Getty mentioned in the book was about the song Slipping from the album My Favorite Headache. It's about his relationship with Nancy.
Yeah.
And I went back and listened to us talking about that song on the episode we did about My Favorite Headache.
And were we right or no?
We nailed it 1,000%.
Really?
We did not think the song was about Getty's relationship with Nancy. We didn't say that.
Oh.
But everything the song was about was, I mean, it's pretty obvious what the song is about.
Oh, look at us.
Well, we didn't think that Getty and Nancy's marriage was on thin ice like that. We didn't know till now.
Yeah, that's true. Just as a note, I forget almost everything I say as soon as it comes out of my mouth. So I have no idea what we said about Slipping.
So next, chapter 24, Neil reaches out to Getty and Alex seeking gainful employment. And they're very happy about that because that means Neil's coming out of it. And he's ready to work again, which is great.
Right. And he talks a little bit about Neil getting back into the swing of things and the writing of Vapor Trails and how Getty had to ask Neil to, you know, use the word I less in some of the lyrics because he felt like it was not as universal as they could be because obviously Neil was writing specifically about himself. And since Getty has to sing it, he wanted the word you in there a little bit more. So just a little glimpse into the back and forth of their working relationship.
Yeah. And the other interesting thing I thought was how detailed Getty got into the difficulties of mixing Vapor Trails and how distorted everything was sounding. And he wasn't happy with the finished result because they did end up remixing it. He didn't talk about the remix, but he talked about how unhappy he was with the original recording the day it came out.
Yeah. I'm surprised that they even put it out then if he was so unhappy.
I think it was too late. It was already done deal. The record company was ready to release it. This is what they had, and they had to go with it.
Have you ever read anything about the band themselves talking about how they didn't like the recording?
I haven't.
You know, at the time, I didn't think that they really disliked it that much.
I don't think they disliked the songs. I don't think they disliked the album itself. I think they just dislike how it sounds. And I agree with them. I don't think it sounds great.
Yeah, a lot of people agree.
So then they get into Snakes and Arrows and meeting Nick Raskulinitz and working with him. And that was a cool chapter. Just hearing the interactions that Nick had with the band. He just didn't give a crap, man.
He just didn't give a crap, which is exactly what they needed.
Oh, absolutely.
And the funny thing is hearing Getty talk about how Nick would just pester Neil about things. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, you would think that you wouldn't say anything to Neil about drumming, but Nick would be actually in the studio, like not in the control booth or whatever. he would be in the room with Neil, like air drumming along with Neil to show Neil how he wanted something to sound, which sounds like a suicide mission, if you ask me. But he has these ideas and he just is so enthusiastic about the project, and the band loved him for it.
Just that he had the balls to go in there and do that, Neil had to respect it, right?
I know. Yeah. He was pretty young at the time, right, Nick?
Oh, very young. Yeah, 30s, I think.
Yeah. And he also talks about how Nick is like just truly 100% American. He's always using words like badass and kick ass and so funny.
So around this time, we also gets into a lot of deaths of friends of his and how tough it was. Oscar Peterson Jr., his friendship with Shelley Knott, who was on his staff, and the death of Andrew McNaughton, the photographer.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just so much tough stuff going on in Getty's life throughout his life.
Yeah. And he's a resilient guy. You know what I mean? He understands the nature of life. Not that everything doesn't sting, but he has a certain perspective on things just because of the way he was brought up and the things that happened to him as a child. It's just a very interesting outlook on life.
And like he said at the show, he's good at grieving.
Yeah.
I guess you get good at it when you have to do it a lot.
Yeah, I guess so.
Now, the other part of the book that I thought was really interesting, and I had not heard this much detail on this, Neil bringing up retirement, the conversation that he and Getty and Alex had about retirement, and Neil wanted to postpone the tour in 2015, and Alex didn't want to postpone it. He wanted to do it sooner rather than later.
Because he felt like he couldn't do it later.
Right. And Neil, the only thing that was going to stop Neil from postponing it was Alex saying, I can't postpone it.
Right.
And so Neil was like, God damn it.
He pulled the one trump card.
The one trump card, which became the R40 tour, which was their final tour.
And yeah, and Getty goes into how angry he was that they only did, 35 shows for that? How he wanted to continue.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to, you know, continue the tour and do some overseas dates. But Neil was getting happier as the tour was coming to a close, and Getty and Alex were becoming sadder.
Yeah. Alex started feeling better, and he probably could have done more.
Yeah.
And Getty, of course, didn't want to retire at all.
Yeah. He was totally dedicated to the touring life. But Neil made a good point saying that he didn't think that they could do anything better than Clockwork Angels. He didn't think they could top it, which I think is a very insightful take on his part.
And I think it's true.
It is totally true, which is unusual for Neil because he was always looking forward to the next album. He always said, you know, his favorite album was whatever album they were working on and most recently recorded. But for him to say, and I think this might be not the best we can do, but like the best we have done, and that he didn't want to take another chance on doing something and like tarnishing their legacy.
Yeah. Well, Neil always wanted to improve on everything. And I think he got to the point in his playing and perhaps in his lyric writing that he felt he hit his peak and it was just going to be downhill from here.
Yeah.
And it might possibly have been if they had continued.
Yeah. We've said it a dozen times if we said it once. There's no better final album from any band ever.
Yeah. I mean, you just can't keep going up. Eventually, you've got to jump the shark, right?
Right.
Start going back down.
Right.
And Rush never did that, which is great.
Never did.
So after that, we get into the really tough part of this book, and that is Neil's cancer diagnosis and battle with cancer. And these are things that none of us were privy to, and Getty's taking us behind the scenes, and it's awful.
Yeah, it's very sad and very emotional, especially when Getty talks about the regret he has for the anger he felt at Neil for wanting to, you know, stop the tour.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just, like I said, this book is just filled with sadness.
Yeah. And the thing that was a positive within all that sadness is Getty telling the story about how Neil listened to Rush's entire catalog on the way back and forth from his Bubba Cave in his final days. and then made a point to tell Getty that he had done this and that how proud he was of the work they had done together. I mean, I can't even imagine the conversation. Getty must have felt so happy and so sad at the same time hearing that.
Yeah, at the Beacon show, he choked up a little bit when he was telling that story. It sounded like they had never really patted each other on the back a lot over the years. So it was good to get that kind of validation from the guy who you spent 40 years playing with, right?
Mm-hmm. And then in chapter 28, Neil passes and he talks about visiting Carrie after that and going to the memorial. All of this happened within the few days between when Neil died and when the fans found out about Neil's death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then soon after that was the first lockdown.
Right.
And then that's how we got this book.
And then Getty talks about not using the R word. He doesn't want to retire. He has no intention of retiring.
Obviously, right? He did the big, beautiful book of bass. This, his new television show.
Yeah.
It's going strong.
Getty's got a lot going on.
Yeah.
So what do you think is next for Getty and Alex? From the interviews I've read and heard, our friend Brian Hyatt had Getty on the Rolling Stone Music Now podcast, and he went into a lot of this. Getty's ready to make music again. It's pretty clear, right?
Yep.
He wants to write with Alex again. That's pretty clear. He would perform live with Alex again if Alex were willing. That's pretty clear.
Yep.
And if they record or perform live again, it will not be under the name Rush, which is pretty clear.
Yes, that's pretty clear.
There's no Rush without Neil.
Right. But there was also a story that came out, I don't know if you saw it, and I can't remember where I saw it, ClassicRockMagazine.com or something like that, when they played at one of the Taylor Hawkins tribute shows, Paul McCartney told them that they should get back on stage and play together. Paul McCartney.
Yeah. Well, he's been through the same thing. I mean, one of his best friends died and he kept on going.
Right.
He didn't call it the Beatles though, right?
Right. I mean, if anything's going to convince Alex to play, I would think it would be Paul McCartney telling you to play.
Well, the thing I keep going back to is our conversation with Maya Wynn and how she's been trying to get Alex to play a show live with Envy of None, and Alex has not been interested in that.
Right.
Why is that? Maybe he's just not feeling healthy enough.
And I don't know how you feel about it. I don't know how I feel about them going on tour, playing, not playing as Rush, but playing Rush songs. I don't know how I feel about that.
I would feel okay with it. Let's say Getty and Alex did a record and they called it Lee Lifeson. They put out an album and they went to tour the album. They could play the songs from the album. Getty maybe could play one of his solo songs. Alex could play one of his solo songs. And maybe they do a couple of Rush songs for the encore. I think I'd be okay with that.
Yeah.
No, you're still skeptical?
I don't know. We've talked about how perfect the ending of Rush was. And I don't know, maybe we should just leave the perfection where it is.
But does that change the perfect ending of Rush if they're not calling it Rush?
I don't know. I just don't know how I feel about it as a fan.
But take it from Getty's perspective, okay? He's 70 years old, right?
Give or take, yeah.
Should he just stop making music because you're not cool with it?
Of course, Steve. Of course he should listen to me. Yeah, well, I don't think this is a situation where, you know, people say that George Lucas ruined their childhood by doing the prequels. I just feel like it ended and let's just leave it at that.
But Getty might still want to write with his best friend, Alex.
Yeah. And listen, if they put an album out and tour, I'm going to go.
Yeah.
That's obvious. But, you know, it's a delicate thing. I think they just have to approach it delicately. I'm sure they would do a great job.
Oh, of course. And maybe that's what Alex is waiting for. Maybe he doesn't want to tour with anybody else but Getty.
Yeah, maybe.
That could be it.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense to me. So overall, Jer, as we talked about at the beginning, I thought the book was well written, gave us great insight into what makes Getty tick.
Yeah.
Soul-bearing, emotional, but still entertaining and funny.
Yeah, it's everything you'd want in a biography or an autobiography. I just loved it. One thing that I found interesting, and I've heard Getty say this before, is that one of his favorite singers is Bjork.
Yes.
He mentions Bjork at least three times in this book about how much he loves her voice.
I like Bjork too.
I do too. So I was just like, oh, I haven't listened to Bjork in a long time. So I went on Spotify, and Bjork has a few live albums that she put out that were from her first few tours.
Right.
And if anybody's never really listened to Bjork's voice, if you want to know what Getty's talking about what an amazing singer she is, there's a version of Big Time Sensuality, which I think is from her album Post.
Yes.
On this live album called Debut Live that just showcases her voice and her range and the weird things that she can do with her voice.
She's amazing.
She is an amazing singer.
And I think Big Time Sensuality is on the album Debut.
Oh, is it on Debut?
Yeah. So Debut Live, it would make sense.
That would make sense.
The one thing that this book screams to me is that we now need a version from Alex. I want to hear Alex's story now. Don't you?
You do?
I kind of do.
Yeah, sure.
I don't think he'll do it, but I think I want to hear it.
Yeah, let's get it. Let's get people on that.
Whatever people there are that get on that, get on it.
Yeah.
So what's next for us, Jer?
I was going to have lunch.
I don't mean today.
Right now.
I don't mean today. This is the end of the fall season. Will there be a spring season? Will we be back? What do you think?
I don't know. I have no idea. It depends. It totally depends on so many things I can't even tell you. What do you want to do?
I think we should come back. If there's a reason to come back, we'll be back.
Sure.
Simple as that. We could try to get some new guests.
Yeah.
Put some episodes together and see what happens. We'll leave it open-ended. How about that?
Yeah, let's leave it open-ended.
Leave it open-ended. You can find us on Twitter. We are at RushFanCast, Instagram, and Threads at TheRushCast. Email Jerry, let him know what you thought of our conversation about my effing life, therushcast@gmail.com. Lex did the bass intro and outro. He's retired for the moment. And Jer? He's not retired. Lex never retires.
No.
He will not say the R word. He's kind of like Getty. Got a quote to wrap this up for us, Jer?
Sure, and of course, it's from Mission.
Mission.
We each pay a fabulous price for our visions of paradise, but a spirit with a vision is a dream with a mission.
Thanks, Jer. Talk to you someday.
All right. See ya.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.